Emily Cooper. I'm the Chief Housing Officer at the Executive Office of Elder Affair. We know that you guys are working hard to deal with this pandemic, and we're really appreciative that you took time out to be on this call today. I'm going to be moderating this call, and we're hopefully going to get have some good discussion and get some good information out to you all. But before we get started, we may all be Zoom experts by now, but some of us, like myself, are still learning. So I'm going to ask Lynn from Leading Age to just do a few minutes on technology and letting people know how they can ask questions and things like that.
Thank you, Emily. Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. I just wanted to talk through a couple of the functions of Zoom that we'll be using today. So the default for joining this meeting is for everyone to be muted. So I just want to go through the couple different ways that you can unmute yourself if for some reason you would like to ask a question or make a comment. So for those of you on your computer, you should notice a toolbar in which you'll see a small microphone icon. If you click that and re-click that, it will unmute you as well as remute you once you have made your comment. We do ask that you remute yourself after you've made your comment. For those of you who are on the phone, you will want to use the function *6 to unmute yourself and then again to remute yourself. So a couple of other functions to mention. For those of you on your computer who see the toolbar, if you click on the Manage Participants list, that should bring up a sidebar that shows you all of those folks who are joined on today's call, as well as some buttons on the bottom. And there should be an option to say yes or no if we have a quick question that we'd like to take a poll from people. I am not seeing the raise hand function on mine, but if you see a little blue hand icon, that gives you the option to raise your hand so we know that you have a comment. Alternatively, for those, again, on your computer, there will be an icon that says chat that will bring up a sidebar that has a box where you can type in any questions. Numerous folks on this call will be monitoring that function during this call, so we ask that you do use that for posing questions if there is not an opportunity to jump into the conversation, that you please put your comments and questions there. If those on the phone, obviously you're not able to send questions through the chat box. If you have a question that you would like asked, you can feel free to send me an email. My email address is lmonaghan@leadingagema.org. Again, that's lmonaghan@leadingagema.org. So I think that's all for technology.
Great. Thanks, Lynn. You make it sound easy. Before we get started, we just want to have a few welcoming remarks. So I'm going to turn it over to Robin Lipson from the Executive Office of Elder Affairs.
Hey, good afternoon, everyone. This is Robin Lipson, and I have the pleasure of working with Emily each and every day. I'm the Deputy Secretary at the Executive Office of Elder Affairs, and I really just wanted to share two thoughts with you. The first is I wanted to thank you all for joining us, and thank you for the work that I know you're doing every day. I know that you are, in many ways, on the front line of this public health crisis. I know that you are dealing with tough situations and having to make decisions every day that probably were not fully laid out in your job description. So thank you very much for that. And I also wanted to say that we are just very, very committed to finding ways to work in partnership with you and to support you, especially as you identify service needs and service-related issues for the folks living in your properties. So thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Robin. And Amy Stitely from the Department of Housing and Community Development, do you want to say a few words?
Sure. Thank you all for taking the time today to tune into yet another Zoom call. But and thank you, Emily and Robin, for bringing us together, Mass Housing, DHCD, CDAC, Elder Affairs, to try and have this forum that really crosses all of our agencies so that we can get the best information out to you, the people who are operating senior housing, in a timely fashion. So thanks for joining.
Thanks, Amy. Dave Ng from Mass Housing. Dave, can you hear us? All right, we seem to have lost Dave. We're going to go to, how about Sarah Barkin from CDAC?
Thanks, Emily. Very glad that all of you could join us today. I know many of our private housing borrowers whose projects we have in portfolio are here on the call today, and we're certainly talking to others as well. We've worked for a long time in the supportive housing arena, particularly on senior housing, and are starting to hear about some of the challenges that many of you face. The other role that we play at CDAC is we convene a group of state agencies through the Supportive Housing Production and Services Committee, which is part of the Interagency Council on Housing and Homelessness, and collaborate there with EOEA, Mass Housing, DHCD, and others. And so very glad to be able to work with our other state partners to try and help disseminate information and hear about what those of you on the front lines are dealing with. So thank you for joining.
Thanks, Sarah. I don't see Dave. I think he might have had a technical difficulty, so I'm going to skip that and we'll keep going. So why did we bring you here today? We really recognize your important role in helping our state's older adults stay healthy, and we appreciate that independent housing, like the properties your agency owns or operates, are key locations where older adults reside and congregate. And we've been hearing a lot about nursing facilities and rest homes and assisted living, but the DHCD, Elder Affairs, Mass Housing, CDAC, we know that there's also a huge portfolio of senior housing, both publicly funded through, publicly operated by public housing authorities and private subsidized housing that is on the front lines of this. And we want to work together to develop ways to support the well-being of your older tenants during this public health crisis. Some of the things that we've done that you may or may not be aware of is we started a listserv. So hopefully you are on the listserv because that's how you actually found out about this call. And it's our way of getting information out to the field, sharing guidance, sharing things we've heard about, best practices. If you're on this call, you should have already received a listserv announcement or two, and hopefully that's been useful, and we'll continue to use that over time. We also established a dedicated email address, seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov, and we will put that up later in the screen, later in the presentation. But that's an email you can use if you have questions, if you have experiences you want to share. Let us know what you're experiencing. And we might not have all the answers to all the questions, but we are working together to triage that and to get information to you that might be helpful. We're also asking your help in making us aware of the cases and emerging clusters of positive cases that you're seeing. We know that you're working in many cases with the local boards of health, which is great and what you should be doing. But that information doesn't actually get really fed to the state housing agencies. So we're kind of lacking this awareness of what's going on in your neck of the woods. So if as you go in your day-to-day life, if you start seeing positive cases, maybe two or more residents or two or more staff are confirmed positive, please email us and let us know. We then can coordinate better at the state level, and when we're having conversations about how to deploy resources, we can know that this is going on in your community. The last component of this initiative is these weekly calls. We're going to have these every Thursday at noon. We're going to have different topics, so if you have ideas of things that you want to talk about, send us ideas through that email address, seniorhousingcovid19@mass.gov. So I think that's it for you listening to me talk. What I'd like to do is turn this over to Dr. Katie Brown, who is the state epidemiologist from the Department of Public Health, who we're lucky to have with us. We've asked her to talk a little bit about her role and DPH's role in addressing this pandemic. So Dr. Brown, I'm gonna turn it over to you.
Great, thank you, Emily. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Excellent. All right. So good afternoon, everyone. And I just want to echo everyone's appreciation for everything that you're doing and for having me on the call today. You know, people keep referring to this as a public health crisis. And while I think that is somewhat accurate, we really need to acknowledge that this is a societal crisis in many ways and that it requires this multi-agency, cross-disciplinary approach in order for us to really tackle all of the issues that COVID-19 is causing in our lives. Just the huge amount of disruption that we all have. So yes, it's a public health crisis, but it involves all of us. I think this is the classic example of it takes a village. So thank you for everything you're doing. So from the department standpoint, I will tell you that I work in the Bureau of Infectious Disease and Laboratory Sciences. So that is, I primarily deal with, I should say almost exclusively deal with infectious diseases. Probably most of you don't know what an epidemiologist is, and I think the best way to say it, and it also sounds the best, is that we are disease detectives, right? So we work on any infectious disease, you know, foodborne infections like salmonella, influenza, and, you know, COVID, just to name a few. And our jobs really are broad in scope. So the idea is that we need to help track burden of disease and also identify who and where who's being impacted and where the diseases are occurring. So, you know, it really is about identifying sort of the groups that are most at risk for this disease or any disease. Geographically, are there differences that we need to take into account when we're communicating with people? And then, you know, gathering all of that information and sort of learning about who's at risk is only so useful. You have to then take it and apply it to control measures. And so sort of epidemiologists do that full spectrum of activities. And you can imagine that with COVID-19, because it's a new disease that we're all learning so much about so quickly, and because there are so many people infected with the disease that this is a very busy time for all of us. So in Massachusetts, we have sort of a unique public health structure. So there is the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, which is the state public health authority. And then there are 351 individual local boards of health. So each city and town has their own local board of health authority. And by law, the State Department of Public Health and the local boards of health have what are called coordinate powers, which means we sort of have equal authority in jurisdictions to perform these public health roles. But in reality, local boards of health are given sort of the first right of first refusal to deal with public health issues in their jurisdictions. And so they should always be your first point of contact when you have public health questions that are arising in the city or town that you work in or live in. So, surveillance for this disease is conducted in several different ways, but essentially what happens is that people get tested for COVID-19 and those laboratory results are sent to us at the department. We share them with the local boards of health, and then a public health authority, an epidemiologist or a public health nurse, contact those cases to talk through what the sort of next steps are. And the next steps are all about controlling and preventing further spread of the disease. So when someone is sick with COVID-19, they go into isolation. And this is a specific public health term. It means separating yourself from, you know, everyone in order to help reduce the chances that you are spreading that disease to anyone else. There are, you know, again, and I'm not going to give you all the details right now, because they are complicated, but there are specific rules about when someone who is sick from COVID gets to sort of resume their more normal daily activities. And it requires that, you know, a certain amount of time has to have passed since they got sick, and there has to have been a significant improvement in their symptoms. So they're going to spend a minimum of 7 days in isolation in order to help us, again, prevent the further spread of the disease. So when a case of COVID is identified, the other piece of this is called contact tracing. And so the public health authority will talk to the person who has been diagnosed with COVID and is going to help work with them to identify anyone that they may have inadvertently exposed to the disease. We now know that although most people are most likely to spread disease when they have symptoms, coughing and sneezing, that's really the way this disease is primarily spread, there is some possibility for them to spread the disease in the 2 days before those symptoms begin. And so that's why I say they might have inadvertently exposed people. If you're sick, we recommend everyone stay home. But if you are, before you get sick, and you know, you're not aware that you are infected, there is the potential for spread. And so talking with the diagnosed case of COVID, we identify everyone that they spent time with in those 2 days before they got developed symptoms, and look for people that they have had close contact with. And again, close contact has a very specific definition. It is spending time within 6 feet of someone for more than 10 or 15 minutes. So sort of like walking past someone in the street does not constitute an exposure, but standing and having a conversation with someone that lasts for 10 to 15 minutes, that would represent an exposure. And so then those individuals who possibly were exposed, they go into quarantine. And quarantine, again, has a very specific public health definition. These are people who end up needing to separate from others, usually at home. And they need to do that for 14 days. To see if they develop symptoms of this disease. If they don't develop symptoms of this disease in that 14 days, then they are free to go about their business. And then sort of the last control measure that I really want to talk about is the social distancing. So isolation is for people who are actively ill. Quarantine is for people who have been exposed, and social distancing is for the rest of us, which is something that we should be doing every single day with everybody to the extent possible. You know, in your own household, it can be a little bit difficult, but other than that, you should have conversations with people standing more than 6 feet apart, or you have your conference calls by Zoom, which is what we're doing here. And so those are some of the really important public health control measures that are put into place. There are a lot of documents that are available on the mass.gov website, and maybe even too many documents. It can be hard sometimes to find the information that you need, but that is where most of the information that you need to help respond and to answer the questions that you might be getting, that's where those documents exist. And so I would very much encourage you to go to the mass.gov website. Up at the top, there's a banner that says learn more about COVID-19. And if you click on that, it will take you to the website that has the COVID-19 information. And then you can look for, the category of information that you're looking for. So that is one of the primary ways that we are coordinating, not only with our other, with coordinating between all of the different governmental agencies, but it's also how we're coordinating with local boards of health and with all of you so that everybody has access to the same information in the same place, kind of at the same time. And so I would really encourage you to check out that website because I do think it will have some useful information for you. I'm going to just say two more things and then I think we're going to move to questions. And one is, and this was actually one of the first questions, but I'm just going to say it up front, that I know that many of you or all of you are dealing with populations of individuals who are almost certainly at higher risk for severe disease from COVID-19. So about 85% of people with COVID will have what we call mild to moderate disease. It will not require hospitalization. You know, they're going to feel like they have a cold, some people a really bad cold. But, you know, those are not the individuals who are most likely to have severe disease. Severe disease is really more likely to occur in individuals who are over the age of 70. And I will tell you that of the cases that have been identified in Massachusetts so far, 85% of them are occurring in people over the age of 70, okay? And then I will also say that that is also, those are the age groups where death is most likely to occur as well. These cases are more likely to be fatal in individuals over the age of 70. There are also some pre-existing chronic conditions that make people more susceptible to severe disease, and these include things like diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, obesity, kidney disease, suppressing conditions. And so any individual who has chronic disease should really sort of think of themselves as being at higher risk. And of the data that we have, 98% of the individuals who have died from COVID have had a pre-existing condition. And so you are dealing with populations that are likely to be at higher risk for severe disease or even death from COVID. So the last thing I want to say is that in addition to the isolation, quarantine, and social distancing, there are other sort of general public health recommendations that can help reduce the spread of this disease. So the social distancing is key. There is now a recommendation to consider the use of cloth face masks, particularly in situations where it's hard to do social distancing. So if someone goes to the grocery store or the pharmacy or whatever, that might be a good place to consider the use of a face mask. Hand washing, I cannot ever overemphasize the need for hand washing. It is really important. Soap and water for 20 seconds. If that is not available to someone, then the alcohol-based hand gels are very good as well. Staying home when you're sick. You know, we're all supposed to be social distancing and kind of staying at home in general, but if you are sick in particular, you really need to stay home because, again, for COVID-19, as with most respiratory diseases, people are most likely to spread disease when they are ill. So I think, Emily, I'm going to leave it at that, but definitely want to turn it over to you to so that I can answer some of the questions that might be out there.
That's great. Thank you so much for that information. And Dr. Brown, can you just repeat the website? I'm seeing in the chat room people want to know the website you referred to.
Oh, sure. So this is the Maine state website. Maine as in primary, the Massachusetts state website. So it's www.mass.gov. And again, there should be a yellow banner at the top that says learn more about COVID-19 or something like that. And if you click on that, it will take you to the COVID-19 pages.
Great, thanks.
Yep.
So you touched on this a little bit, but can you also just go over again the data on the percent of people who've died in sort of context of demographics and underlying conditions? So, you know, we hear all the time that older adults and immunocompromised are most at risk for death. Can you give us, just go over that again, just in case we,
yep, you know, miss absolutely. That? Absolutely. So again, so far there have been 433 deaths from COVID-19 in Massachusetts that have been reported to us. Okay. About 50% of them we're still investigating. So I don't have, you know, background information on all of them, but of the ones that have been fully investigated, 98% of those deaths have occurred in people with an underlying condition. Okay, so they have one of those chronic conditions that I mentioned that make them put them at higher risk for severe disease. And then I also just want to say that both hospitalizations, because that's, you know, more common with severe disease, and deaths are significantly more common in individuals who are over the age of 70. And then there's another jump for individuals over the age of 80. So sort of, you know, unfortunately, the older you are over 70, your risk escalates rapidly for both severe disease and death from COVID-19.
Thanks for that data. That's, you know, I think for these folks, it's frightening because they're on the front lines. So what should a senior housing operator do if they become aware of the resident in their building, you know, assuming it's a big, you know, apartment building, test positive?
Right. So what I strongly recommend is that you connect immediately with your local board of health. Okay. I mean, that's the first step, right? So I outlined the process by which, you know, the department and a local board of health gets notified about a case. And there is then the public health need for them to follow up and do this contact tracing, you know, talking to the individual, making sure they're going to isolate, and then identifying their close contacts and putting those individuals into quarantine. I do want to be clear that we have not seen, so I'm going to say almost never, but you know, never say never, right? There is almost never a need to do any type of public notification about the occurrence of a case, all right? And I do need to sort of reinforce for everybody that in public health, we have legal mandates that require us to work to protect people's identity unless there is a public health need to disclose the information, okay? So there is almost never a need for somebody to, do a public disclosure about someone who was a case who was at a grocery store, for example, okay? Because in general, other people in the grocery store were not exposed by this individual. If we were, and I say we, I mean the public health system, if someone identifies a case and learns that there are sort of unknown people who might have been exposed, that will be the time when a public notification needs to happen. So again, what I would advise all of you to do is if you become aware that there is a resident in the building that has tested positive, connect with your local board of health. They will be the ones that will have the information about who is actually potentially exposed by this person. They are the ones that can institute the isolation and quarantine requirements. These are actually legal authorities that the local board of health has. And so those are the people that you should be working with if and when, and I should just say when, because it's so likely to happen, you have a case in your building.
So that's really helpful. And I think we're getting some questions of not the reverse, but a different situation, a similar situation where there is, you know, somebody lives in an apartment building, is not feeling well, goes to their doctor, the doctor runs a test, tests positive, that gets reported to the local board of health, but they live in an apartment building. Is that something where the board of health would then notify a property owner or landlord that there's a case in the building and they should take certain steps?
So I know that this is not the answer that people want, but it is the real answer. And the answer is not necessarily. So you would be notified if there is a public health need for you to know, if there are actions that you need to take to help protect the other people in your building, you would be notified. If there are not, if that person, you know, did everything that they were supposed to do, which is, you know, being good about social distancing and, you know, not going out when they were sick, except potentially just to get to the doctor to get that test done, then again, there may be no general risk. In fact, there probably will be no general risk to the other individuals in the building. And so, you know, this is sort of where concern meets the need for the need to maintain patient confidentiality, again, unless there is a public health need to share that information.
And if the information is shared, depending on what happened, they may or may not, the local board may say there's somebody in your building and they may or may not say who that is.
That is correct. That is correct. And, you know, there's a lot of responsibility on the individuals who get sick as well, right? So, and this is a place actually where I think the building owners can help. So there is some responsibility by the people who get sick, right? They need to be, you know, to talk to their local board of health, tell them who they potentially exposed, what their activities were, so that all the right public health measures can be put in place. They also are advised that if, you know, they're advised actually that they should not have visitors or anybody into their apartment. And that would include maintenance, for instance. And so if something were to go wrong in the apartment, they would, it would be really their responsibility to make sure that they inform the building owners so that all the appropriate precautions could be taken to ensure that the maintenance can happen, but also that the maintenance workers are not put at potential risk. And the public health people that talk to these cases are very clear about, you know, what the duties and responsibilities are of these individuals.
Great, thank you. So some other people were asking about these sort of the landlords are on the are really get to see how people, how some of these tenants and residents react, and some of them have been told to quarantine and haven't, or for example, aren't social distancing. You know, they hang out in the common area or the lobby, or, you know, they've asked visitors not to you know, be coming into the non-essential visitors to be coming to the building, and family members are still doing that. Do you have any suggestions of what to do in those kinds of situations?
So, you know, I think that using some of the resources that are available on the mass.gov website, you know, which include a lot of these sort of recommendations for the public about how to reduce spread of COVID-19, having those materials available for all of the residents, posting a sign on the door, the front door, you know, where people are entering, that, you know, to help protect COVID-19, don't be sick, you know, wash your hands, make sure you stay 6 feet away from other people. You know, we live in the United States, right? I mean, we saw that China was able to institute some really very strict policies that are more difficult for us to employ in the US. For people who have been actually told to isolate or quarantine, the local board of health has a legal authority to be able to make that happen. And so if there's a specific concern around someone who is sick and is supposed to be isolating, or was exposed and is supposed to be quarantining, call the local board of health. The rest of this is a little bit more complicated. I will say that Governor Baker, you know, has one of his orders is that you don't have groups of people larger than 10. And so that's a a gubernatorial order where, again, there could be some legal action taken if that is defied. But for a lot of this, this is really teaching people about what the appropriate recommendations are and why it's so important to do these things, you know, and really encouraging that adoption of these personal behaviors. This is always hard with public health when we're really asking kind of everyone in the public to help us protect everyone in the public. And there are going to be people, I think, who choose to not do everything that they're supposed to. But by being transparent about what the recommendations are, sharing them with everybody, and also sharing the reasons behind them, I think that helps encourage appropriate behaviors.
So I'm just going to pepper you with a few more, and then I think we'll open it up to folks on the call to see what questions or feedback they have. We're hearing a lot about masks, PPE, N95, respirators, protective coverings. There seems to be a lot of different words. Housing providers are starting to feel like they should be saying, anybody who comes in this building should be wearing a mask. Is that the right thing to say? And what's the difference between all those? And what really is the best course of action?
All right, so I will try to say this briefly. So PPE is personal protective equipment, and it has a specific meaning that is pretty first responders. Okay, so surgical masks and N95 masks are specific types of personal protective equipment that when used in association with a face shield and gown and gloves and all that, helps protect the coworker or the healthcare workers from getting sick when they're caring for patients, and also helps them prevent them from transmitting the disease between patients. But, you know, those are requirements that are specific for healthcare workers and certain first responders. The rest of us do not have access to those types of personal protective equipment. And I have to be clear that, you know, there are, I think you've probably seen the news, there are shortages of some of these materials. And it's really important that we conserve those types of personal protective equipment for healthcare providers. However, recently, again, because we now know that people can transmit the virus before they become ill, there's been a recommendation to consider the use of fabric cloth masks. There isn't a lot of data behind the use of the cloth masks. And so, you know, at this moment in Massachusetts, we're not sort of ordering the use of them, but certainly encouraging consideration of those. They are most effective probably in places where social distancing is not really possible, so where you can't stay 6 feet away from someone. And I want to also mention that cloth masks don't protect you, but they could help protect other people if you have the virus but don't know it yet. And there are several sort of easy, cheap ways to just make your own masks. Those are available on the CDC website, and we have a link on the mask.gov website that goes directly there. There's ways to like cut a t-shirt to, you know, to create a mask. People are even talking about bandanas. But there's information about that on the website, and I would encourage people to direct them there. I'm not sure that they can be required in the buildings, but that would be a legal question for someone else because I am not a lawyer.
Well, you do know a lot of things, though, even though you're not a lawyer. So thank you. Yes, I've heard of people using yarmulkes recently as face coverings. So. All right, well, so I want to open it up to other folks who have questions either for Dr. Brown or for any of us on the call. I did see one come in that I thought was useful for you, Dr. Brown. Folks are wondering if the local boards of health actually have the ability to contact people in different languages. So if the person who tests positive's first language is not English, is there some way that they're getting, you know, some sort of, you know, getting the information in a way that they can understand it?
Yeah, that is a great question. And the answer is yes. The local boards of health have been given access to phone translation services. That has, you know, just innumerable languages that you can work in. There are also not all, but many of the materials that are on the website have been translated into the materials for the public have been translated into various languages. Some of that is available.
Great. Do we have any questions from folks, Lynn, that have emailed you or that we're seeing in the chat room?
I don't believe so. I think that you have covered most of them in the chat. I have not received any emails, but I did want to just remind folks that if you would like to unmute to ask a question, you will need to click on your computer on the microphone button, or if you're on the phone, press *6 on your telephone to unmute yourself.
And if you do that, I'd ask that you just tell us your name and where you're calling from. So is there anyone who'd like to ask a question?
I see something in the chat room, Emily. Amy here. So this was from somebody saying, is it the housing operator's responsibility to report to the Board of Health a positive? I mean, like, what is their responsibility for their own residents? Because if they are not told, then they can't. What is their responsibility as housing owners to report to the Board of Health if they know that there is a resident who's positive?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess what I would say is that they're not required to report it, but I would really encourage them to talk to the local board of health to make sure that the local board of health knows. In the reality of the reporting mechanism is that while the laboratory result does come to public health electronically, there sometimes can be a little bit of a delay between when someone is told that they have COVID-19 and when the lab report arrives at the local board of health. And so I would encourage landlords and owners to go ahead and contact the local board of health if they hear something, even though it's not necessarily a requirement.
Okay, great.
So there are some questions they wanted to know. Folks want to know, won't the resident's doctor report it if they tested positive? What about, there seems to be this confusion of, there's definitely some people who are, I guess, presumed positive or are not being tested, but the doctor said stay home anyways.
Yeah, this is an issue, right? So the tests are not everybody is getting tested. The governor has a task force that has been working on this, and we have expanded testing availability quite remarkably and rapidly in Massachusetts. And so tests are much more widely available. But for some individuals, it is possible that their doctor will tell them that they have or probably have COVID-19 even without a laboratory test. The doctors have been given, healthcare providers have been given the isolation and quarantine documents. And they are, in general, we're hearing, handing them out to their patients that they are diagnosing with COVID-19, so that, again, there is some personal responsibility here that people need to understand what their role is in helping to protect the public. I will just also say these isolation and quarantine documents, sort of in a both in a little bit of a legal framework, but also in a more user-friendly version, are available on the website.
So we have a question. I think there's sometimes concern that the residents or the people who, you know, yes, it is their responsibility, but they may, due to cognitive issues, you know, be unable to sort of, or due to a disability, not able to really quarantine in the way that is probably the safest. Do you have any suggestions of what to do in those situations, particularly with seniors who may you know, be living in the community and have lots of in-home supports that are keeping them there, but have some cognitive decline and may not grasp the responsibilities in the same way.
Yeah, that it's a totally fair question. So this is not, you know, unique. This is not a problem that is unique to, you know, the group of people on the phone today. This is something that that the state has been working on relative to individuals in homeless shelters and also individuals with substance use disorder. And so there are options that are available for placement of people who are unable to adequately isolate or quarantine and are viewed as posing an ongoing public health threat. And again, those are situations where what you need to do is get your local board of health involved sooner rather than later, and they can help you work through those scenarios.
Great. Are there other questions from folks on the phone that want to unmute themselves or type in?
Hi, my name's Deb Foley, and I am a property manager. I'm the deputy director of 10 properties in Central Worcester County. But my question is has there been any cases in the housing, you know, this type of independent housing? I know we've heard about nursing homes, and they've had their issues. And then there was that one property, I forget what town it was, out by Boston there, that had the cases in several of their residents. It was like over 250 residents in the that was housed there, but not that had the COVID-19. But have there been many in the housing that we're dealing with that have had the issue?
So Dr. Brown, do you want me to jump in for this one?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. So what I will say is that the quick answer is yes, but I'll say it's not being, senior affordable housing isn't licensed or certified in any way by the state. So we don't have a mechanism in the way that nursing facilities and assisted livings and things of reporting in that same way, like, oh, by building. So we at the state have been trying to gather information in different ways with the state housing agencies to find out about cases. DHCD has a relationship with the local housing authorities, who are definitely reporting on cases, and there are cases in housing authority buildings. And we're aware from both Mass Housing and DHCD, we're aware of cases in senior affordable housing properties as well. But that awareness, as I mentioned, is somewhat limited. So we are calling on you guys to reach out to us to let us know. We don't always see from Elder Affairs, we may get information about positive cases from the service provider end. We don't always know that all those cases are all living in one building.
Emily, thank you. Could I just add one thing quickly to that, which is that, you know, COVID-19 hasn't been around very long, but we have learned a lot about it. And we do know that it is highly transmissible, but the places where we are seeing sort of these large outbreaks, you know, real significant clusters of disease, are not in apartment buildings. They are in long-term care facilities. They are in hospitals. They are in nursing homes, and there's something about sort of the way those places are set up and the fact that healthcare personnel are moving between rooms, and I'm not throwing the healthcare personnel under the bus. This is a transmissible virus, okay? So nobody's doing anything wrong, but this is literally, you know, these are the places where these kind of large outbreaks and clusters are occurring. And so I'm not saying that it's impossible that there could be an outbreak in an apartment building, but that really everything that we know suggests that it's these long-term care facilities and hospitals that are a little bit more pose the much greater risk for outbreaks.
So we have a question in the chat room a couple of questions. And I'm wondering if either Lynn Fidler or Robin Lipson or somebody from Elder Affairs is on the phone and wants to take this. The question is there an effort at Elder Affairs level to limit who is coming into the buildings and what type of workers and what they're being asked to do? And I know there's a lot going on in Elder Affairs with regards to that for people who are getting in-home services. So Robin, I see you unmuted. Do you want to say a few?
Sure, I can start and then if Lynn is still able to be on, she can add. So I think we all understand that it's important to limit the numbers of kind of transmission vectors in any given setting. And so if people are receiving services from ASAPs, which I know many people in housing in your properties are, the ASAPs some time ago, 4, 5, 6 weeks ago, started looking at their consumer lists, looked at the prioritization of needs, and with Lynn's help, have really changed the kinds of services that people are getting or minimize the numbers of people going into the buildings and have very thoughtfully tried to organize services in a way that they're only delivered in person if they are essential and can only be delivered in person. There are many situations where services are being delivered telephonically. There are examples, for instance, if someone was coming in to cook and shop, we may have replaced that with a meal being delivered. Or if somebody had three workers coming in to do three different things, we may have changed that to be one worker coming in. So that has been very much our MO for several weeks now. And if it's not visible to you, know that we have done that. And Lynn, do you want to add anything that I might have missed? I can't tell if you're still on the line or not.
Lynn, if you didn't hear, you'll need to press *6.
Yeah, Lynn Fidler. Sorry, many Lynns. Lynn Fidler.
Nope, another Lynn. If you need to unmute yourself on the phone, you'll need to press *6.
So I'll pretend to be Lynn Fidler for a second, and I think the only thing.
Hold on. Did I get it?
Yeah. Okay. Lynn Fidler, do you want to introduce yourself as well, because folks on the phone may not know who you are.
Yes, thank you very much, Emily. I'm so successful at this *6 today. So this is Lynn Fidler, the Director of Home and Community Programs with the Executive Office of Elder Affairs. And Robin eloquently stated some of the actions that we've been engaged with for our experience with COVID. Every day is a learning day. We have taken the steps that she outlined, as well as we have worked with the ASAPs that are providing care through providers to identify those consumers that truly need to continue care based on their medical conditions and support structure. So that is another area that the evaluation has occurred to ensure that those individuals needing the most care are still successfully getting the most care in the most appropriate and efficient way, with minimizing contact with multiple people, multiple providers, and really focusing on essential tasks and activities. And the one thing I would say is, as individuals are going into consumers' apartments and homes to provide care, they may have a title that may not be truly reflective of the types of tasks that they're doing. So somebody might be called a home care aide or a homemaker, but just know that the essential tasks that they're providing are truly essential, and they're ensuring that the person that is living in their apartment or their home is really getting this care that they need and they can't go without.
Thanks, Lynn. So I think we have time for about one more question and then a little housekeeping. Is anybody on the phone wanna, or on the, Lynn Monahan, did you get any emailed questions?
I see a couple in the chat. I see some in the chat room.
Okay.
One was for housing operators, what is the responsibility to maintain confidentiality in terms of reporting to the local Board of Health? That's one. And then the second one I saw was, sanitizing apartments if somebody tested positive. Anything to say about that?
Yeah,
Yep. So they're reporting to the local board of health. I mean, they are the authority that is legally allowed to know about cases. And so you are safe to provide that information to the local board of health. That does not violate patient confidentiality, okay? What would violate patient confidentiality is if you sort of announce to everybody in the building that so-and-so had COVID without there being a public health need to really do that, okay? And then the sanitizing question, that's a great one. Thank you for asking. So there are a list of EPA-approved sanitizers. They're actually not super special. I mean, they're easy to get. So there's two recommendations. One is that, you know, in this time of trying to prevent the spread of COVID, it's a good idea to do sort of extra cleaning in your house and clean what are called high touch surfaces, like your kitchen counters and maybe your bathroom, with one of these approved disinfectants. And again, there's a link on our website that will take you to the list of approved disinfectants. For someone who has COVID in their apartment, again, there's no need to go in and do a deep clean unless that person is moving out for some reason and then somebody else is going to be coming in. But again, the sort of generic sanitizing and cleaning with the approved disinfectants is appropriate.
So I have that it's 12:59 and I'm conscious of people's time, especially nowadays when we have so many things going on. I appreciate you being on the call. I know there were some folks you might hear who tried to get on. We had there was so much demand, but we are recording the call and we will post that link and send that out through the listserv. Just a few reminders, I have put on the screen what we've said is the dedicated email. So feel free to send information there, ask questions. We will triage with the other state housing agencies. Please let us know what you're going through, what's working, what isn't working. And again, if you are, we don't really have a reporting mechanism for cases. So without giving any identifiable information, we don't want that. But if you want to report to us when you have learned of multiple cases in your building, that will help us as we think about working with the state around resources. Send us ideas about topics you may be interested in hearing about for the next call. And I want to thank both DHCD, CDAC, Mass Housing. I also really want to thank Dr. Brown for taking the time with us today. And I also want to thank Leading Age for helping out and being the wizard behind the curtain on all the technology today. So stay safe out there and keep doing a great job. Thank you, everybody.